May 13th, and we're recording live here from Toronto, Ontario. I'm a Canadian gal, loving our weather this year. I was just talking with our guest, and I'm looking forward to the show. It's going to be a great show. I'm going to sort of forego all of my usual introductions to who I am and all that because I want to get on with Divine Blessings Radio and our guest today. So I'm going to just jump right in here, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about. What I'm going to do is our guest today is author Peter Canova of this amazing book called Pope Annalisa. And it really caught my attention right off the bat with the whole concept. So, and I've got a copy of the book which I've read, and it really is phenomenal. So I'm going to read you the description of Pope Annalisa. Sister Annalisa Bisanjo heals the lame and the blind. She foretells events. She may even bring the dead back to life. Annalisa rises against a background of murder, betrayal, and assassination to become the Pope, yet she sends ripples of fear throughout the highest levels of the Vatican as she introduces her new way, and the world plunges into war. The Church teeters on ruin, and terrorism runs rampant. Is she a savior or the long-predicted false prophet who will cause the downfall of the Church and lead the world order to ruin? Four special people are destined to answer this question, that for the female pope indeed carries a secret within her that will transform the world one way or the other. In their quest to unravel the mystery behind Annalisa, they will not only discover the shocking truth about her, but about themselves, and in so doing, they will touch upon the very origin and destiny of humanity. Whether savior or heretic, whether good or evil, before the end, everyone will come to realize that in the world of Pope Annalisa, nothing is as it seems. So that's the description of the book. And this book has already started winning awards. It has won the Nautilus Gold Medal Book Award for adult fiction and visionary fiction. The announcement, the official announcement, will be made in New York on May 26th at Book Expo America. And I just want to tell you a little bit more. The decision was apparently unanimous among all judges at all levels, and the book received the highest ratings achieved in the category, in this category, in several years. The Nautilus Book Awards has one of the most rigorous judging processes of any national book award contest. It must pass three panels of judges located across the U.S. They're composed of people with successful careers as editors, writers, librarians, school teachers, and bookstore owners. It's a very intense examination and scrutiny of the book. And this incredible book, Pope Annalisa, now joins the ranks of best-selling authors and past winners, including Deepak Chopra, Eckhart Tolle, His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, Carolyn Mace, other authors, Mariel Hemingway, Greg Braden, and many more. So, I encourage you to check out the website popeannalisa.com, and you won't be disappointed. This is one fascinating and riveting book. So now what I want to do is I'm going to tell you a little bit about the author, Peter Canova. At the age of 23, Peter Canova first realized his abilities. I'm going to slow down because I'm stumbling over my words. I'm so excited about this. That's why I'm sort of getting ahead of myself. Okay, Peter Canova first realized his abilities to do intuitive medical readings, remote viewing, psychokinesis, and other psychic phenomena. This led him to a conviction that all humanity and all life is interconnected at an unseen level. As he traveled four different continents for his work, a variety of spiritual figures entered his life unsolicited, thereby reaffirming this belief. Peter started writing in earnest after he stopped working for 8 months to take care of his wife, who was battling cancer at the time. He combined his love of writing with his spiritual background and his travels to produce a fictional work entitled The First Souls Trilogy. The trilogy concerns the first fall of spirit into material existence as told through the lives of characters whose incarnations appear over different epochs of history. And Pope Annalisa, the first book, tells of an African nun who becomes the first female pope in a near future world headed for self-destruction. So I'm gonna leave it with that. And now I wanna I want to get on and welcome Peter. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the show. It's such a I'm so delighted to have you here today. I've just been so excited about this book.
Well, it's great to be here with you. Thanks for having me. And I'm happy to tell you that you gave me a nice introduction. Since the winning of the Nautilus Award, Hope Annalisa won a second major National Book Award, which is the Independent Publishers Award. I guess that bills itself as the world's largest book competition or book awards, I guess by virtue of the sheer number of entrants in the book. And Hope Annalisa has also won that award just last week.
That's really wonderful. Congratulations on all this wonderful stuff that's happening with the book. It's speaks volumes, and it's very timely. The messages in the book are certainly very timely with what we're all going through and experiencing. And I just want to mention to our listeners, well, first of all, our call-in number, let me get this over, just sort of tell people the call-in number is 347-934-0704 in case anybody would like to call in and perhaps make a comment or ask questions, Peter. And also the chat line is open, and so please feel free to talk amongst yourselves in the chat room or perhaps ask questions there. And I've listed popeannalisa.com in the chat room for people who want to go check out the website. So now, you know, I have to say, when I got the book, I couldn't put it down. It was so riveting, and I would say it's probably if not my absolute favorite book, it is like right up there, Peter. It's an amazing, amazing. It's so riveting and page-turning. I just didn't want to put it down.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's interesting about this book is that it's really kind of two books. One of them is the aspect that you just captured. A lot of people just really, you know, kind of relate to it for the story and the fast plot line. The other side of the book is a parallel story. The one behind the scenes explores a lost spiritual tradition that was once part of our early Western legacy that was very feminine in character, as you kind of mentioned in your interest when we were talking before in the divine feminine. And some people, really just love it for the spiritual content in there, and it's a practical sort of spirituality, not a theoretical spirituality, but it's a very practical spirituality that tries to connect us directly with the divine, so that we can have our own personal experiences and not sort of take our spiritual beliefs, on faith by sort of old dogmas and pronouncements from of institutions or other people. So does have that kind of delicate balance between just being a great story, which some people like it for, and some people like it for the spiritual content in the book.
Yeah, I happen to be someone who really likes novels. I love novel reading. They're my preference over self-help kind of books. I actually kind of tend to fall asleep or get bored or restless when I'm reading self-help books. So novels really I find gripping and I gravitate towards them, and there's certainly not a lot out there that incorporate not only a fascinating sort of adventure, but also bringing in teachings, spiritual teachings, and really getting the reader to sort of question and have get insights and have aha moments and are able to sort of like reflect on your own life as to what's been happening and that. So it's very well, it's a beautiful combination of both, riveting read as well as, really fascinating concepts.
Well, I feel a lot like you do. I think the times I've enjoyed learning the most from reading is through stories. Stories somehow have a way of bringing, learning and wisdom to life. And this was a very conscious decision on my part when I wrote this book because, look, a lot of this book, very frankly, could have been in a self-help book, but there's many authors out there that are doing that and doing a great job on it, probably better than I could. I mean, the various bookstores, both in, mainstream book chains and metaphysical bookstores, have tons of authors that are dealing with spiritual matters in self-help form. And I really felt that the way I could best communicate what I wanted in the written word was through telling a very interesting and compelling story where people could experience the message of the book by living and breathing with the characters of the book itself. And I think that has a way of bringing it to life and, you know, just really putting flesh on the bones.
Absolutely. Stories have a wonderful way of helping at least me anyways, to be able to put things in perspective as to, you know, you have the teaching, but how do you apply it in your life? And that's the nice part that I like about stories is, you know, you can, I find anyways, I can reflect more on things that have happened in my life and go, oh, okay, now I get it, now I see, that makes sense. And
yeah.
And that. So what inspired you to write the book?
You know, it was really kind of a combination of circumstances. The very first concept I had about the book was probably about 11 or 12 years ago. I was in a screenwriting class. I was very early in my career of writing. I was actually in something very different beforehand. I was a developer, international developer, doing luxury hotels all over the world, and so it was not something that you would think would be, you know, like your stepping stone into the literary world, but I always had an interest in writing. So I started attending a few writers' conferences, and I was in a screenwriting class, and the instructor came in and said, I want you to do a high concept idea and bring it in for discussion. And by high concept idea, she defined that as something that, you know, nobody's ever really done before. Well, that's a pretty daunting task, because almost everything we do in life is, you know, a permutation of something else that happened before us. But anyway, I started thinking, and I said, okay, well, what haven't we seen before? And being a spiritually inclined person, I guess, you know, my mind started tracking in one direction. I said, well, you know, we've never really seen a woman as Pope before. And then from that, I kind of keyed on and said, all right, what would the world be like? What would the church be like? What would the world be like? And what would life be like for her, going against the grain of you know, a 2,000-year-old institution to break all these barriers and taboos and everything? And, you know, I just started playing with it from there. And then over the course of a decade, I would write little snippets of the book. Actually, I wrote the book backwards. I visualized most of the book in my mind. It came to me in pictures and in information in my meditations, and it actually started backwards. I wrote the final scenes of the book first and then proceeded my way back from there into a story. And it was a process over 10 years where I would write little snippets when I was on the airplane traveling around, because my job didn't really leave me a lot of time and energy to really devote full time to this. So it was really kind of a part-time project, but a very passionate part-time project that I never relinquished. I never let go of it. So I'd always come back to it whenever I had some spare time. And then it was really the last, that period of time when I was helping to take care of my wife, there was a lot of emotional energy, as you can imagine, surrounding, you know, circumstances like that. And I was getting a lot of information coming through at that time. And that's when I probably put the heart and soul of the book together during, you know, that 2-year period.
A couple of points that I wanted to touch on there that are both fascinating is the way you wrote the book is almost like a project manager style of, you know, getting to the end first and then tracking back what are all the things that you need to do to get to that end state. So,
that's a good point. I never thought of it that way.
As a former project manager myself, that's you know, it's like, you know, what is the end state? And okay, so I'm working backwards. What are all the elements and timelines that need to take place in order to reach that end state? So that I found fascinating. But also, you know, I want to mention as well, Peter, you know, like congratulations and kudos to you in writing a fascinating, riveting book with these spiritual elements, but also from a perspective, you know, when you talk about having written, pulling this together when your wife was experiencing cancer and putting your heart and soul into it, that really comes through in the book. And it's not very often, in fact, I think it's very rare that you can have a male author be able to bring that sort of like heart and soul into a book, because there were parts when I was reading this book when I got really emotional and choked up. And I think that's from any of the books that I've read, that's rather rare that a male author has been able to bring that into the writing.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean it was I think like anything, writing a book is a cathartic experience. I mean, it's the author really getting parts of his or her personality out onto paper, hopefully with something of common interest to other people in terms of, you know, what you've learned in life and how you've processed through that, you process that information through your own being and your own experience. And one of the key themes, as you've probably picked up on in the book, is the whole idea of bringing the male and female energies into a balance. And that's something that I, you know, have practiced. I guess to a certain amount it came natural to me because I've had an intuitive side in my life, and I've had the logical side of my life. I've had the side of my life where I was just, you know, an international businessman. I've had the side of my life where I was a writer, and I had to be, you know, more cognizant of artistic sensibilities and things like that. So somehow in my life, I guess, you know, probably somewhat conscious and probably very much unconscious, I was probably always working towards this balance of the male and female energies. And I guess the book here gave me a chance to, you know, express that, that more intuitive side. And I think that this goes back to some of the ancient spiritual wisdom teachings that's discussed in the book, where it was so important, where they stressed that, you know, in order to be a whole human being, we really have to take the basic energies of the universe, which, although they may be one in their essence, they express themselves in multitude forms. And here in our physical world, they certainly express themselves as a yin-yang polarity that, you know, the ancients described as, you know, male and female, and that bringing those into balance is what creates, you know, a whole human being. And when we become whole human beings, we can create a more holistic world.
Yes, I agree. So maybe now actually might be a good time to ask you, what would you say are the primary messages that you are trying to convey to the reader? Because, you know, there's a few things going on in this story, and it was great the way they all wove together. But what would you say are the primary messages that you would hope that people would be able to get from the book?
Right. Well, you're right. There is a lot going on there. So without, you know, ticking off a whole list of items here, if you really wanted to boil down, I think what I was trying to convey to the readers is that I had certain spiritual experiences in my life that were enlightening. Now, I don't consider myself an enlightened person. I consider myself a person who has glimpsed enlightenment. And I've got a long ways to go on the road, like pretty much all of us do. But I had certain realizations, and they later on, I subsequently, you know, confirmed a lot of this through reading the experiences of these ancient mystics 2,000, 4,000 years ago, and, you know, how they delved into the, I guess you could call it the realm of the divine or the realm of higher intelligence, and they brought back information which was just extraordinary. You know, a number of these things correlated with my own, you know, my own experience, and led me to believe that there's some real truth there. And I think I was trying to write something that would encourage people to think of spirituality or God or whatever, out of higher intelligence, out of the box of the traditions and the dogmas that we've been circumscribed with through our religious upbringings, you know, Judeo-Christian traditions, Islamic traditions, whatever the case may be, because these spirituality really transcends religion, and that's a lot of what this book is about. It's about all the religious differences we have and the strife that's being caused. That's much of the plot line of the book, is the conflict between the Western and Islamic worlds and terrorism and whatnot, and all these apparently religious motivated conflicts, and that, you know, that there is a way spiritually that we can transcend that, because there is a spiritual truth that runs through the basic mystic core of all religions, but it gets lacquered over by the institutional aspects of religions, because that's when ego and power and position take over, and then, you know, we forget a lot of what the original spiritual force or impetus was about. And I always say that, you know, prophets are the ones who speak the heart of God, their followers are the ones who start religions. And it so often happens that way. And I think that I'm trying to encourage people to take responsibility for their own spiritual growth. And, you know, responsibility is something we hear a lot of these days. It's almost become like a kind of a pop culture cliche. You know, you have to take responsibility for this. You have to take personal responsibility for that. And, you know, that's probably a good thing. But the one thing that we really don't take very much responsibility for is our own spiritual growth, because we're so busy in life, and it's been that way since, you know, the metaphor being cast out of the Garden of Eden to till the earth by the sweat of our brow. People are trying to survive. They're trying to put bread on the table, send the kids through college, hold on to their job, and it leaves very little time for most people to really sit down and think of the fundamentally important things, which is who we are, why we're here, what we're supposed to be doing, these philosophical and spiritual questions. And, you know, for each of us to take responsibility to be seekers and to go along that path, and this book was written to help people think in that manner and begin that journey, and to take responsibility so that we're not giving over our spiritual power to institutional religion, to governments, or to science. You know, I think one of the reasons why the mystic aspect of spirituality died out in the Western world is because when in early Christianity you had two main streams. You had the Gnostics, who were the mystics, and then you had the Orthodox, which is pretty much the form of Christianity that we've been handed down today in the main Christian denominations. And I think the reason that the Orthodox won out was simply the fact that, well, for most people, it's easier to go to church, say confession, be absolved by the priest, and go home feeling like we accomplished something spiritually. Well, that really doesn't do much. It's kind of a shell game that we play, a smoke and mirror game we play with ourselves. It kind of gives power over to the priests and the church, but it doesn't really do much for us spiritually. So I guess this book is saying that, you know, we do have the possibility to have direct communication with the divine. Many people have done it before. It's not impossible, and it doesn't take a unique or exceptional individual to do it. It does take someone who has a fervent desire to seek and to know and to understand, and at least an initial reliance or an initial proposition of faith that there is something else out there that we can touch, that we can touch or that can touch us with information about how to better our lives and, you know, with higher guidance. And it's very much about having those direct experiences with the enlightening experiences with the divine and trying to encourage people along a path to get there.
Yeah, there's, you know, I have post-its and I have pages dog-eared and because there's so much going on in the book. I mean, in one aspect you have you know, the very sort of material physical worldly stuff with, you know, threats of war with Iran and U.S. and oil over oil and whatnot and terrorism. So there's those elements that are in the book, and then there is the elements of you know, a lot of what you were just saying about you know, the whole process of discovering our you know, how we can connect with God, and you know, you're doing that through Pope Annalisa, who, you know, through very incredible circumstances, you know, becomes the first elected female and African pope. And, you know, one of the things that I, in the book, with all of this going on and with the concepts that you're bringing forward about the divine feminine and, you know, we'll talk about the ideas of Mary Magdalene and the lost, you know, her you know, how sure she was sort of written out of the Bible and all that. But What I also liked about the book was how you did it in such a way that you weren't church bashing, you know, you weren't coming out and, you know, saying the church is wrong and all of this and that. It was all done in a very very fascinating and thought provoking way to look at things from you know, more than just one perspective. You know, and along with that, what I also appreciated was how you sort of were able to reflect all the different things going on within the book with, you know, the Iran and U.S. and the war and terrorism and all of this, along with all of the dissension amongst the the Catholic Church, but not doing it from making anyone look like they were evil, you know, or they're the dark forces who are trying to whatever you, you know, everyone, you were showed everyone with the perspective of, you know what, there are people who believe in what they're fighting for, and whether it's, you know, fighting through actual warring or fighting with words or, you know, just trying to hold on to what they believe in. I really appreciated how that was all done, in that it's like you don't get the sense there is a bad person or an evil force in all of this, or, you know, someone trying to sort of like control and manipulate the world kind of thing. But everybody's just kind of like, you know, they're fighting for what they believe in.
Yeah, well, you brought up some really great points. Let me see if I can touch on two or three of these. First of all, one of the things about the book is that the spirituality book is very practical, and that's why it's very much involved with world politics and religions and practical things like plots and assassinations, unlike self-help books we mentioned, which kind of divorce themselves from that, and they seem to talk on a more ideal level about things. And, you know, I'm a Capricorn. I'm practical, and in keeping with the balance that we talked about, my attitude about spirituality is that it's got to have practical applications into our lives. So therefore, the spirituality that involved in this book is very much presented as solutions and interweaving through all the political and military and socioeconomic plot lines of the book. It's all woven in there, into one fabric. It's not just spirituality, you know, on some mountaintop in a cave. The second thing is about the church bashing. I think in general, a lot of people spend way too much time complaining about things and not leading their way out of their problems by example. And in the book, that's essentially what really happens here. I think the church is like anything else in life. It's had its great moments and it's had its really low moments. You know, it's been responsible for a lot of suffering, and it certainly has its negative aspects. However, it also has other positive sides to it. I mean, there's some great people in the church. They're not all child molesters. There's great, you know, parish priests, and the church has a very vast intellectual history. I mean, it's a repository of a lot of knowledge over there in the Vatican, even though sometimes it's a little cloistered away too much. But it was a very conscious decision, not to sit around and bash the church or any religion for that matter, because the book wasn't out to make a frontal assault on people's beliefs. It was about to say your beliefs are what they are, and you know, that's neither good nor bad, but there's another way to look at things. And so it's sort of like, instead of trying to destroy the box, it's just trying to show the opening outside the box so you can get outside and take a look at it from a different angle, from a different perspective. You know, and finally, the point about the characters in the book, well, it's really true. I mean, there's very few characters that sit in there and, you know, kind of like wring their hands and say, ha ha ha, let's figure out how we can destroy the world today. Most people in life, even the ones that we would call evil, are really fighting for something that they believe in and something they believe is right. It's really a matter of perspective. Now, that's not to say that there's not such a thing as evil. I tend to view evil really as being synonymous with ignorance. Evil is we depart from the light and we depart from a good path by our ignorance. We essentially get so tied up in the material world and trying to control our world by the standpoint of our own needs and our own ego that we often run, you know, counter to a more harmonious plan that we're not in touch with. And I think enlightenment, to a certain extent, is understanding the unity and the harmony of life and getting into rhythm with that. And then at that point, we start to walk the good path. But evil really is a deviation from that path, and it's a reliance on our own egoistic needs as a basis for controlling other people and other things in the world around us. So the characters, there are some truly bad characters in the book. I mean, as you probably picked up, there's several of them that are nasty guys in there, but they're nasty guys who really believe in their cause.
Yes, yes, Yes. So it just sort of brings a more of a human perspective of, you know, we tend to, you know, when we think of evil and, you know, it's this, you know, I don't know, I think we disassociate, you know, we label someone as evil and then, you know, they're no longer human kind of thing. one of my favorite themes in the book, actually, from our themes or messages that Pope Annalisa tries to convey is, and this is a quote, evil itself dances to God's purpose. And I really like that. I think that's a really important message for people to understand that, you know, it's not about them or what they're doing or the dark side or whatever, but that everything that we do experience in life does you know, it does bring us back to God. You know, that's the sort of design of it. There is a higher purpose for the things that we experience and all the things that go on in the world. At least that's my perspective anyway.
Well, yeah, I mean, as human beings, for one of the things in the book is that, you know, which may shock some people, but the good and evil are really two sides of the same coin. We as humans,
yeah,
are all creatures. We're all creatures of light and shadow. Every single one of us. Every single one of us carries the shadow. In fact, I suspect that the shadow even extends up to certain dimensions of the higher dimensions, because the part of the ancient mystical belief was that the universe and reality as we know it come through a series of emanations or projections of God's essence outward, and that the further these projections go out, the less of an understanding they have of the source. Kind of liken it to, you know, when you make DVDs or CDs, the original copy is always the purest, and every subsequent copy you make gets a little bit degraded, you know, in terms of clarity. Well, that was the view of the ancient world in terms of how reality was projected, that even spiritual beings were projected outward as parts of God until finally they reached the material dimension in a crystallized energy form that we call, you know, humanity. And it's so the ignorance of our source is the greatest down here at the lower, you know, spiritual dimensions. But we are all creatures of light and shadow. And the degree to which we begin to remember our origins and realign ourselves with a true source of being, which is light. It's not shadow. Shadow is in effect an illusion. It's an illusion because we've forgotten what our source is about. And when we start remembering what our source is about, the shadow starts to lift and the light starts to come in, because the light is the true ground of being.
You know, and that was you know, you talk about being an emanation of God. I liked that sort of that interplay or the description or the message that came through in the book, and it was one of those things that had me stop and think, and it fit or resonated with me when you sort of brought forward the idea of being a creation of God versus being an emanation of God, and that there is a difference. So maybe you might want to, can you talk to that a little bit more about, like, what were you trying to say for the listeners who are listening in, like, from that, you know, being a creation of God versus an emanation of God? What was the message there?
This is kind of a good segue to talk about the spiritual tradition, which we've mentioned a couple of times here. The real spiritual theme that runs through the book was that there was a universal ancient spiritual tradition, and the threads of this tradition ran through every major religion in the world that we have today, and even through the pagan religions of the past. And this tradition was pretty much destroyed by Orthodox Christianity in the West. And it's a little bit complex. The tradition has a lot of permutations, and so it's hard to pin it down to one easy definition. But a very distilled form of it will tell us that human beings are entities containing projections of God's own spiritual essence. So the view of the ancient mystics and the view of our early religions before they were altered, and I'm talking about Judaism, Christianity, and Islam now, that these were the views that many people of those religions in their very early days subscribed to, these views that humans are not just simply a lump of clay that was granted, you know, life force by a deity outside of us. And then, you know, like little clay, we were wound up like little clay dolls, and we're now bouncing around the insane asylum of life here. That's generally the view of the three Abrahamic religions. A very different view that these early religions had was that humans were actually projections of God's own essence. Now, maybe projected very far out from the source and very far out from the center, but nonetheless contain that spark of divinity. And that our real goal in life was remembrance of that which is already within us. That's why Jesus was always saying in the Bible, seek the kingdom within, because the kingdom, meaning God, is within. And, you know, you can touch bases with your divine source. It takes work, it takes effort, but we have that potential in us. And so that, you know, we're really divine by vibration, slowed down to such a level that we're condensed into these seemingly solid forms. And it's kind of like thinking of ourselves as holographic representations of the true reality. And the best analogy I give to that is if you all are Star Trek fans and you remember Star Trek TV series, they used to have the holodeck on there where the crew would go in for rest and relaxation, and they would create these worlds that were, you know, virtually real, almost indistinguishable from reality. Well, that's sort of what we've done here. The spirit essence in us became so overwhelmed by the low vibration and the denseness of the material world that we lost sight of what we truly were, and we started to identify with the boundaries of our skin. So almost like being on a holodeck, you know, this seeming reality that we have here on Earth, which, you know, is physical or material life, seems like what reality really is, but it's not the way it is at all. There is an underlying reality there that we've forgotten. And incidentally, this is not just what this ancient spiritual tradition is saying, but it gets into some fascinating parallels with modern science, because this whole idea of the hologram theory, the holographic theory of the universe, is a very well-defined scientific theory now. And more information is coming out, or more and more, I would say, a larger body of work is coming out now that is defining reality and human life as being information. And it's information that is projected by, you know, these hologrammatic means to project ourselves into what we think is a solid reality here. But all these scientific theories are going back and saying exactly what the mystics were saying 2,000 years ago, that matter is not solid. Matter is actually moving around. It's actually a crystallized form of a higher energy. Well, that's what the ancients said. Einstein said in his theory of relativity that matter and energy are interchangeable. The whole idea of the universe being emanated from a series of pre-existing universes, that's what the ancients said. That completely is in concert with the modern parallel universe theory, which, where they're saying, you know, that we are a result of pre-existing dimensions, that we live side by side with these other dimensions. And it goes on and on, where the mystics of, you know, 2,000-3,000 years ago completely predated all these modern scientific theories, including the Big Bang, the holographic universe theory, the fractal theories. I mean, it's just shocking how science is essentially rediscovering what these people are saying, of course, in the terms of their time. They lack technological terms, but if you strip away the cultural and technological differences, they were saying the same thing. So these mystics that were going inside subjectively in their own meditations were bringing information back from higher dimensions. And how do we tell that that wasn't just, you know, pure imagination, that these guys were smoking desert weed, because a lot of them did come from the desert? Well, we now have these scientific theories that are saying much the same thing. So perhaps where the wisdom of the ancients in this mystic tradition start to converge with our findings of modern science, maybe that's the closest thing that we come to truth, because it's approaching it from both the subjective experience and the objective scientific pathway.
Yeah, it is that sort of ultimate blending of matter and spirit, right? Is that, you know, it is amazing, it's incredible, it's wonderful to be seeing you know, science validating, and, you know, coming back together with spirituality. Like, they are, you know, they're not separate, but they're part of the whole. You know, one doesn't exist without the other. One validates the other, and it's that whole you know, mind and heart connection, I guess you could say. Yeah.
Yeah, well, certainly there's scientists, you know, there's scientists that are going in one direction who, you know, like in a more Darwinian direction, who completely believe that there's no reconciliation between science and spirit. But I think you're more perceptive scientists, and especially you'll find the ones who are in fields like molecular biology and advanced quantum theoretical physics, who are on the forefront, where they have to examine, they're forced to examine the boundaries of reality, where materiality starts to fade into something else. These are the guys who I think, you know, are probably most receptive to the and astounded by the ancient spiritual teachings, because they're on the forefront.
So, you know, I want to ask you, how much of the story is based on sort of real legends and prophecies, if any? You know, we talk about, you know, part of the storyline is about the great deceiver
the great heretic and the great deceiver.
Yeah. So how much of the storyline is based on what you would consider real legends and prophecies?
Most of it.
Most of it.
I don't know if I could put a percentage on it, but I'd probably say 90% of it. I don't know that a great heretic or great deceiver was mentioned as pointedly as it was in the story, but there is a body of Catholic prophecies that definitely predicts the downfall of the Catholic Church. And, you know, in Revelations, that there's always been the whole, you know, idea of the rise of an Antichrist. So I would say maybe almost 100% of the story is based on actual spiritual traditions, lost gospels, and prophecy. But you know, in the form of a story, you'll take separate prophecies or separate things, and you'll distill them down into one storyline. So you won't find this all in one book, let's say one ancient document or something like that. It'll be scattered around a number of documents for purposes of the storyline. You know, I pulled all these separate or disparate prophecies and things together and kind of merged them into a storyline.
Okay. And was the idea of choosing an African female pope, was that purely fiction, or is there any prophecy around that?
You know, I'm not aware of any particular body of prophecy around an African pope. Now, I know practical reality, there are a number of African popes, and in fact, I should say African cardinals. In fact, one from Nigeria in particular, whose name has been kicked about for a while now as being a real possibility, for being a next pope or future pope. So I think the idea of having an African pope in reality is probably much closer than most people think. Now, female pope is an entirely different issue.
Right.
The church, if you would talk to anybody in the church now, they would probably laugh or scoff at that notion, but they would rightly do so if you were thinking within the box of the church, because the church is set up to basically try and freeze everything the way it was 2,000 years ago. Actually, if they really did, they would have women in the church, because that was the real first state of the church. Women were the real leaders, very prominent leaders in the church before they were pushed out. But in terms of what is happening in the world and the way the world is changing, I think that that's where you will see the impetus for women coming into the priesthood coming from outside the church. I don't think it's something that necessarily is going to happen from within. I think the prompting is going to be from without, and who knows, maybe you'll get some inspired leaders someday that inside the church that will resonate with that, and then you'll be getting it on both ends. As far as the African aspect of it was concerned, a couple of reasons why I chose an African female pope. Well, first of all, I lived in Nigeria for several years, so I'm very familiar with the people and the culture there, and that always helps when you're writing a book to things firsthand. Nigeria is also the largest country in Africa in terms of population. It has the biggest population, and it's almost evenly divided between Christianity and Islam. And it's always been like the front line of conflict between the two world outlooks of those religions. You're always reading about different strife and riots and things in Nigeria between the Christians and Muslims, and that conflict between those two world outlooks forms a lot of the backdrop and the plot line of the book. I think one of the other reasons that I chose an African female is that in Africa you still have animist religions, which is a natural sort of earth-based religion, or it's a nature-based religion, I really should say, and the type of spirituality that I was talking about from the ancient spiritual tradition was very feminine in character, very much in tune with the pulses and rhythms of nature, which you know were always viewed as feminine in character from very, very old times. The Earth Mother, the Magna Mater, the goddess, that was actually a prevalent form of worship in earlier times before it was supplanted by this patriarchal dominance that we have right now. And these things are cyclical. I really do see a rise of the feminine energy everywhere I look around me now. And that by feminine energy, I'm not talking about equal pay, the feminist movement, political things like that. Those are outer manifestations of a much broader spiritual current, underlying spiritual current. And this is really a recognition of the female qualities of heartfelt approach to life using creativity and intuition, as opposed to a mind-based approach of life using logic and rational linear thinking, which is of more male qualities. We've been on that analytical, you know, logical side for quite a while now, which is the, you know, expression of the male dominated cultures that we have around the world. And I see that old order crumbling, and I see it, and I don't see it being supplanted by this rising feminine energy. I hope we see it coming into balance, because that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about bringing us as individuals and bringing a world back into balance. And by doing that, I think we have to recognize the feminine aspect of spirituality, the feminine aspect of God, of nature, and so forth, in order to bring us back into balance. And the Gnostics actually believed in that the world was created through the feminine aspect of God. And it was a story that was embodied in these famous myths, the Gnostic myth of Sophia, the fallen goddess. And it's really quite interesting, because even though we talk about it in terms of myth, myth doesn't mean it's just some fantastic story. A lot of people think of myth as, oh, that's just the product of someone's fertile imagination. But myths are far from that. Myths are maybe the highest form of truth we have, because it's truths that are brought back from higher dimensions, but told, like we said in the beginning, in the form of a story. The best way you can relate to people is in the form of a story that they can understand, and that's what the mystics did. They brought back this incredibly difficult, complex information from the higher realms, and the way they could express it to the masses was through these various myths. And the myths essentially became symbols, and if you understood the deeper symbology behind it, these myths could be quite enlightening. And most of these myths were very feminine-oriented and feminine in character, reflecting the character of our earlier societies that have been lost and now are hopefully coming back into some balance.
So maybe you might want to so Mary Magdalene obviously comes up very strong in the book, you know, she's gotten a sort of a bad and lost rap over the years.
Yeah.
Would you like to talk to about how, you know, how you sort of incorporated Mary Magdalene into the book?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. When I started this whole project out, you know, like I said, maybe 11 or 12 years ago, there was hardly anybody even knew who Mary Magdalene was. I mean, even pretty devout Christians, for the most part, haven't even heard of her, don't know much about her. She really has been kind of the lost figure of the Bible. But all of a sudden, in the last 7 years or so, it's just incredible. I mean, it's been an explosion of Magdalene material, both in, you know, fictional form and certainly in non-fictional form, and a lot of spiritual metaphysical works and scholarly works and so forth. And it's kind of like the air is now charged with these Magdalene particles. And I think that Magdalene is sort of symbolic of the rise of this feminine energy that I've been talking about. She's kind of the crest of that wave of a renewed interest in us getting in touch with the intuitive and mystical aspects of our being. And intuition and mystery is really a feminine. Intuition, creativity, mystery, these aspects of life are really, you know, more feminine aspects of life that I think we're now looking to get in touch with, because we're saying, you know, materiality is such a dead end. There's got to be more to it than this. And I think Mary Magdalene is right up there in terms of an archetype or symbol of that. So, but in the actual story, in my actual story, Mary Magdalene does play a very prominent role. A little bit less so in Pope Annalisa, much more so in the second book of the trilogy, The 13th Disciple, Mary Magdalene being the 13th disciple. But
When is the next book going to be published, Peter?
when the first book starts selling and I could stop spending 99% of my life out there marketing the first book and have a little bit of energy to finish the second one. You know, I've got a lot of it done in draft form right now, but I'll tell you, Karen, I think the closest thing I've come to experiencing a woman's pain in childbirth is birthing a new novel here. It's really something else that gets marketed. Yeah. But back to Mary Magdalene. Mary Magdalene was a very obscure figure until perhaps we discovered in Egypt in 1945 these astounding Gospels that were written in Coptic, and they're called the Gnostic Gospels or the Nag Hammadi. Fine, after the Nag Hammadi is the town in Egypt that is closest to the caves where the Gospels were found. And these Gospels were written by early Christians called Gnostics, who were the mystical Christians who were destroyed by the Orthodox Church. And it shed a whole new light on Christianity. It shed a whole new light on the meaning of Christianity, the Christian story, and certainly the role of Mary Magdalene and women in the church. And it portrays women as being among the foremost disciples. In fact, you can discern about seven female disciples that are pretty much named, Mary being the chief disciple. And in fact, Mary was not just the chief disciple of the females portrayed in it, but she was the main disciple, not St. Peter. Mary was portrayed in the Gnostic Gospels. In fact, many Gnostics actually held Mary Magdalene to be the incarnation of the Holy Spirit. In the view of the ancient religions, it was never male or female. The divine energy always acted in unison, and so it would not just be the Christ or the Logos that came down to enlighten the world, but it would also be the Holy Spirit, which was feminine, acting in concert. In fact, the Gnostic myths said that the Christ and the Sophia were a divine pairing in the higher realms who incarnated into earthly experience. And many Gnostics held Mary Magdalene to be that incarnation. Certainly, she was portrayed as being the constant companion of Jesus. And she was the disciple who most understood his inner teachings, the mystical oral teachings that he taught to the disciples. Peter was portrayed as kind of a dunce. I mean, he didn't really get it. And he was very jealous of Mary's relationship with Jesus and the fact that Mary was so bright and understood many of these things that he didn't understand. He was kind of portrayed as being very frustrated at that circumstance and not at all happy about Mary Magdalene.
You didn't exactly portray him that way in the book, though. I mean, he was a doubter, yeah. But certainly not a dunce.
Yeah, he was kind of an obtuse character in the book, a very stubborn guy and slow to, you know, really pick up on the real current behind things. But the whole idea of Jesus having this esoteric teaching has a good foundation to it. First of all, in the Bible itself, it says very clearly that Jesus taught one thing to the masses in parables. But when he was with the disciples in private, he gave the mystery teachings to them. That's alluded to in the Bible. It's also expressed in certain documents of the early Christian fathers before the church went so far into orthodoxy that they had to suppress all this material. Clement of Alexandria writes about St. Mark, who was Peter's secretary, St. Peter's secretary or bookkeeper in effect. When Peter was executed in Rome, bringing back the secret spiritual teachings that were only given to the elect or those who were spiritually advanced enough to accept them. The Gnostics carried that even further, and they were much more explicit about what the sacred mystical teaching was, or the secret teaching was, and that Mary Magdalene was the one who most understood that whole spiritual teaching. And it's kind of an interesting parallel here. A lot of people ask me, well, you know, is your book like the Da Vinci Code insofar as like Mary Magdalene is concerned? In the Da Vinci Code, Mary was pictured in kind of a way that I don't think it was all that flattering. I mean, it's the old bloodline theory that Mary and Jesus had children, and Mary was the Holy Grail in terms of being the receptacle of Jesus' children. Well, she is the Holy Grail in my trilogy too, but she's the Holy Grail, not the receptacle of his children, but the receptacle of his sacred knowledge. She was that disciple. She was the primary disciple who most clearly understood this sacred knowledge that Jesus was teaching, which was not always easy to understand. And not only did she understand it, but she helped him explain it to the others by the nature of the questions that she would ask when they were in council or they were gathering. She would ask specific questions that would draw Jesus out, and the way he answered the questions would help elucidate or explain the mystical teachings to the other disciples. So she was seen very much as almost like a co-teacher of the mystical teachings along with Jesus, and that's much more elevated than just being the mother of his children, being a housewife, you know. So, that's it's very clear that in the early church, women were prominent in the church and in the leaders of the church. They got written out. They started being written out gradually as the church became more orthodox. It became an embarrassment to have so many female leaders because they were competing to be the main religion of the Roman Empire, and both the Romans and the Jews were very, you know, patriarchal societies. So having so many women in the leadership roles became an embarrassment, and they were gradually pushed out to the point where Christianity could be acceptable to Rome, and eventually, of course, it was adopted as the Roman state religion by the Emperor Constantine. I think it was around the year 325 AD.
Fascinating, fascinating. Peter, I can't believe we're almost at the end of the hour. I have, you know, I've got like so many more questions I could ask you. We do have just a few minutes left, and what I want to ask you is specific to the storyline. Maybe you might like to sort of expand on how I like this question. How does Pope Annalisa treat Christianity and Catholicism and the Christian story? As that maybe we can sort of come to a conclusion with. I that's the question I want to sort of end with.
Yeah, well, I think that as we discussed earlier, the thrust of the book is not to bash Christianity or not to bash the Catholic Church, and this is certainly not a Catholic book either for those of you out there who may be concerned that this is a Catholic book. The Catholic Church is always an interesting vehicle because nobody really understands the inner workings of that vast machine over there in Rome. And, of course, you've seen this in operation in the Da Vinci Code and whatnot. But the Catholic Church was really a vehicle used to bring out these different themes and conflicts which have a universal application to everybody in the world today. And it wasn't the purpose to take Christianity and Catholicism head on and bash it and say, you know, look, you suppressed all these beautiful traditions and everything else. The book goes about treating the church the way the Gnostics believed the church was. Even though the church ended up eradicating the Gnostics, the Gnostics said, look, there's an inner and an outer church. The outer church is like, you know, spirituality 101. It brings the masses in. It gives them basic concepts and, you know, at least starts to pull their attention towards more spiritual matters and away from just, you know, plowing the field. But spirituality is a process. You can't just stop there. And that's where the problem has been with organized religion, whether it's Catholicism, Christianity, and any other religion, is that they set up these elaborate structures of beliefs and dogmas, and then they become frozen in time. They become sacred and frozen in time. And okay, this is what you got to believe, and this is how, you know, you get your ticket to heaven by believing in these things. But that's that's not correct in the sense that spirituality is really a process. It's a road that we walk along, and you know, you're never going to get to the end of the road if you stop at the first bus station, and that's where traditional religion wants you to stop, because that's their place. That's where they collect their ticket, so they want you to stop there and stay there. The Gnostics viewed the outer public religion as the stepping stones to the inner mysteries, and that's where they really wanted you to go to further your road. So that's what this book really does. The book really treats the church as if it were, you know, not the enemy, but the stepping stone to a higher awareness for people who were willing to seek and willing to, you know, kind of get beyond the box and realize the church for what it was, just what it was. It's one step along the way. It's one signpost along the way, but never mistake the signpost for the destination.
Perfect, perfect. Yeah. Well, Peter, we've come to the end of our show, and thank you so much for being a guest today. I'm so delighted to have you on and to help get the message out about your book, and I wish you the best of everything for all that you are doing. This is really remarkable and timely and just wonderful information and a fabulous storyline. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
And thank you for having me. I enjoy being here.
Thank you. Thank you to all of our listeners on the show.